In a global industry where anything can happen, where mistakes cost much more than dollars, we bring you expertise from around the world to ensure that everyone goes home safe every day. The internationally acclaimed Oil and Gas HSE podcast starts now with your host, Russell Stewart.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for tuning in again to another edition of the OGGN HSE podcast. Today, my guest on the show is Chris Martin. And Chris is the HSE manager for a company called Deep Blue. Chris, I really appreciate you coming on the show today.
It's my pleasure, sir. I appreciate the invitation, and it's humbling and it's an honor.
Actually, the audience has no idea because I know what we're going to talk about. Folks, you're going to want to hang on to this. Let's introduce Chris a little bit more, kind of give you a reason why you want to listen to this one. Let's establish Chris's bona fides here, so to speak. First of all, Chris, Deep Blue, that's a midstream company in West Texas. Is that right?
Yes, sir. We are a water midstream company that focuses on the Midland Basin. So we service, Diamondback is our primary customer, but we service a number of other oil and gas production companies. As of today, 86 SWDs, about 66 million barrels of pit capacity. We take in, produce water, dispose of it, or treat water, and then sell back fresh water or produce water. So we support fracking, drilling operations, and standard disposal activities.
Chris, that's not on our agenda to talk about today, but that subject right there is something that we might have to, if we can, get you to come back for. Because I think when you're talking about the environment, that's a very, this produced water and water for fracking and all that sort of thing, that's a very important subject. But you spent the last, actually, 20 years in oil and gas. Looks like it's been focused nearly all on safety. You got some kind of associate's degree all the way back in 2004 in occupational safety and health technology, right?
Yes, sir. I was lucky enough to be here where at Odessa College at the time they were, and they still are, offering a degree in occupational safety and health technology. And that's where I met Lynn Reese, who had a tremendous influence on me as a novice in the field at the time. I actually get, like a lot of safety professionals, I got voluntold into it in a previous life in retail and took a liking to it. And so I decided to pursue education in it. Shortly after starting that education, I transitioned into oil and gas safety. I wrapped that degree up in 2004.
Obviously, you didn't stop studying because 2017, you actually get your Bachelor of Science in Occupational Safe and Healthy through Columbia Southern University. Is that right?
Yes, sir, I did. And I can't speak highly enough about that program and the leadership in that program. Every one of the instructors that I had there were industry professionals. I jokingly say the problem with academia is it's filled with academics. In the case of Columbia Southern, you get your real world instruction from people who've been there and done that. It's very heavily focused on reading and writing. You're forced to think deep thoughts about the material, if you will, and how you would apply it, you know, rather than regurgitating on tests. So it was a tremendous experience for me, and I really went back out of self-preservation. At that point, I was working for a Fortune 500 company. The prospects of advancement were severely limited by only having an associate's degree. However, amazing experience. I learned a tremendous amount, and I'm about to start back on a master's in organizational leadership through that same university.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yes, sir.
You've got other designations and degrees here, but let's talk about, as I told everybody at the beginning, why I'm excited about having you on here. With your actually decades now invested in research and teaching, you're actually a speaker on the topic of dispelling the myth that safety is a financial burden to a company. Is that right?
Yes, sir. I learned quickly, and oddly enough, it came from being a managing partner at a safety and environmental consulting firm. I would go in hat in hand to a potential client, and I had to talk them into spending their money on something that was, by and large, in the early 2000s, still very ethereal. Right? The concept of, hey, spend money on training, spend money on, you know, high grading your accident investigation processes by using my team or myself, whatever it may be, that's difficult for them to wrap their head around. Well, where's the return on investment? When you're trying to talk operations people and business owners out of spending their money, they have to see that there's some value in that. It's not just the warm and fuzzies. That sounds great. And most of the folks in our industry are very passionate about what the end results are. We don't want anybody to get hurt. We want everybody to go home with all 10 fingers and toes. And we don't want to spill stuff. And it's 100% true. But at the end of the day, if you can't feed the tribe, the tribe's going to starve to death, no matter how safe or environmentally conscious you were in your activities. I quickly became aware that I've got to figure out how to approach operations in a way where, first of all, approaching them so that they understand that my product adds value to the sustainability organization, and that means profitability, and then making sure that the product I delivered met that end goal.
Okay, I see the wisdom and I see the principles of, I understand what you're saying there. How do you do that?
Well, how much time do we have?
I don't know. We'll see if we get on a roll here.
But at a high level, when you put yourself in that frame of mind as an HSE professional, the first thing you have to do, as odd as this sounds, is you have to speak the same language as the operations people, and you have to get inside their heads and understand how they view value for their company. And that's going to vary by company. When you get into a Fortune 100 player, you get into an Exxon or a Conoco or an Oxy, somebody like that, the way they view HSE as an embedded part of their culture is different than at what we call a checkbook producer in West Texas, who at that time may still have company men wearing shorts and t-shirts on location. But it's understanding your audience's, just literally their language and their thought processes, and then making sure that whatever model you're going to apply to execution delivers on that. It's not rocket science to say profitability equals sustainability, but profitability is a moving target based on market conditions, based on market pressures, those kinds of things. So not getting you so locked in or married to how you execute all the time that there's a one-size-fits-all mentality, because that's going to fail too. Literally getting into the weeds of understanding when someone says, hey, what's the ROR, what's the ROI in this proposal? Well, what does that even mean? How do you measure return on investment in safety training? How do you measure return on investment in a safety leadership program for your frontline and mid-level management, where you integrate them into your incident investigation processes? And what this all came to, right, if I could boil this down to one sentence, is there is no disconnect between employees doing their jobs safely and employees doing their jobs correctly. So if you follow that logic, if you grant me that and agree with it, if you don't, great. I'd love to have that debate. But if folks are doing their jobs correctly, and safety is just an inherent part of that, and being an environmentally responsible actor is being a part of that, then correctly means efficiently. Efficiently means more profitability. The higher the profitability, or the more consistent the profitability, the better the sustainability of the organization, and the more it's able to withstand changes in market conditions. This will be probably the first of several times I quote Nassim Taleb in this. I'm just a huge fan of his. Be anti-fragile. And organizations that execute at a high level with respect to HSE realize greater efficiencies. They realize less waste. Less money wasted on cleaning up spills, paying for incident investigations, or all the things associated with it, paying for damages and hurt people or fatalities, God forbid, and cleaning up spills. All of that helps an organization to be anti-fragile, which is that which is resistant to upset conditions or changes. And I'm quoting Taleb terribly there, so I'm just paraphrasing him. But yeah, that is sort of the short answer of how I approach and how I've approached for a number of years now, creating value through execution and HSE in organizations, whether I'm a consultant or leadership role or in just a contributory role.
Okay, that spills into what I guess we would call HSE training initiatives. And somehow or another, you have to create real value there, right?
Yeah, without question. Everyone in our industry knows that we've got to train our employees. And I would say the first thing we need to do is acknowledge and accept that there's a difference between training and education. Sitting someone in front of a computer and saying, hey, do your CBTs on a monthly or quarterly basis or an annual basis so you can get your HSE bonus, they'll finish them. But what are they getting out of the computer-based training? And this is not a knock on CBT.
No, it's not. But what you just said, you hit the nail on the head. If that's all it is checking boxes and, yeah, okay, I can show you my little card here says I got it. If you don't know how to leave that computer and go out on the rig and put that into practice, you just wasted your time.
Yes, sir. You gain a different appreciation for the value of training from being a consultant, right? So I was one of the managing partners at Nova Safety and Environmental. I was fortunate enough to get pulled into that by Todd Abear and Britt Byerly and Jim Dowling and eventually Charles Castle. Great guys to work with. But we would have starved to death in the training business if there wasn't value added for our clients. Sure, some of them are going to do it, as you said, to check the box. That might get me the first job with them. But what about the next time they need someone to do the training? And when it's the operations leadership sitting in the training, that's the critical eye through which they're looking at. I have a lot of money tied up in this room, right? If I've got 25, 50, 100 people, and you're training them in some kind of generic OSHA topic, anyone can do that. But to get me back to do it the next time, I need them to leave that training session with material they can use the second they leave the building. Something exactly. That adds value for that end user. And so then the challenge becomes, how do I do that, right? I can be a very engaging speaker, maybe. Maybe that's my forte, is I'm funny and everybody likes me and they want to listen to me. That doesn't mean that the training really added value or impacted the end users, though. So it's a matter of, how do I structure training so that there's a real value add? And quite frankly, the cheat code's out there. There's an ASSP book on training that talks about, you know, peer-to-peer education and the value of implementing scenario-based training so that there's real-world applicability. You know, the days of PowerPoint by death and let's stick in this video by God bless them, Coastal, or whoever, those days have to be gone. We've got to be way past that in the delivery of training. And so the pressure I put on myself and on the trainers who work for me was, we must teach in a way and deliver information in a way so that when they leave that classroom, they can go and apply it quickly. And if they can't apply it, they know what they don't know and have a frame of reference and know it's okay to go to my peers. So I have to structure my training to match that. I'm going to deliver some information, and then I'm going to put, say, people in groups, and those groups are going to work through problems. They're going to problem solve together, and then they're going to share across the groups how they problem solved. That accomplishes a number of things in one time. You get the peer-to-peer training. You get people talking. They're not just being lectured to. They're having to apply the information. And then you're creating an atmosphere where the expectation is we listen to each other when we problem solve. And then we help each other. Let me tell you, that's absolutely nothing different than from what happens in, say, failure meetings in oil and gas, where we have a downhole failure or well failure situation. They'll have a meeting where they go through this exact process. What happened? Why did it happen? What do we do to stop that from happening again? And then let's share those ideas with one another so we're constantly learning and getting better. I don't know how we got to that point of comfort in the industry, because I was there when I first started. Now, hey, show them this video on hydrogen sulfide safety and then give them this test. That was the early days. I quickly realized that doesn't work. That bores them to death. And they've seen this video 15 times, you know, Dr. Death riding on his motorcycle or whatever. Let's do something in here that adds value for the end user and makes them realize, hey, when I come in here, they're investing a lot of time and energy into me, and I'm getting something out of this. Training is critical. Again, not a knock on CBT. It has its place as far as a refresher goes. But when it comes to really educating your people and giving them something they can apply, we need to put some more effort in rather than just lecturing or reading a PowerPoint to them.
Yeah, I actually interviewed an HSC professional. I think it was last week. It hasn't been aired yet. But he talked about some of those same things. He even carried it to the point of what he called putting coaches out in the field or out on the rig. Or the analogy was, if professional athletes need coaches, then the people who are in our business performing the work that they perform, they're definitely professionals. And when it comes to safety and efficiency, they can use coaches too. Are you seeing that? Seem to think it was going to become more prevalent.
In my opinion, that should have been the model all along. And the expectation with respect to how I drive that and have been in other organizations where, again, I've worked with people much smarter than me to help me come to that conclusion, was that that's frontline supervision's role now, or should be. And at the point where span of control degrades to the level where that's not feasible, then it probably is time to introduce folks to go out and do job coaching on site. Those models have been around a long time. If you've been exposed to Safe Start or Safe Work, you know, Gary Higbee and that team of people, they're fantastic. But that really is part of the whole observational engagement process, right? Is how do we turn a potential misstep into a coachable moment so that employee gets better, or those employees that are exposed to it get better? Yeah, I couldn't agree more. You know, and the more dangerous the activity, the shallower that opportunity gets. If you're on a rig and you're operating around thousands and thousands of horsepower and your stuff that weighs tons, the margin of error, or as Taleb again says, harm is not linear, right? it shrinks considerably. I think based on the activity, organizations that are willing to, from a leadership perspective, allocate the resources to get that done, they're going to find that there's a return on investment. It all boils down for me to waste minimization and risk mitigation. When I define my role to senior management, they say, well, what does HSC really do? Okay, well, we do two things. The way we do those two things varies greatly. There's a lot of moving parts. But waste minimization and risk mitigation, the coaching strategy applies to both. Whoever this other professional was, like nail on the head. The more folks are doing correctly at their jobs, the less risk is involved. The less risk is involved, the more we're mitigating out risk, the more we contribute to the overall sustainability of the organization. And that's the end game.
Exactly. You mentioned incident investigations a while ago. Let's talk about, you've got some ideas, I think, on some of the pitfalls of that.
I do. It's something in my background, fortunately or unfortunately, I've gotten to investigate at this point thousands of incidents and work with folks from other organizations, be they other contractors or my role at Concho or Earthstone, and now here at Deep Blue as an operator, meeting with vendors, their HSE professionals, and their management teams just subsequent to an incident. This harkens back even further. So Manuel's book on the ANSI standard, which is called Advanced Safety Management, he really emphasizes the importance of what you do with an incident. Now, whether that incident is a near miss or just results in property damage, environmental impact, injury, illness, whatever. What an organization does with that and how effectively they react to it and do with what they learn from it has a tremendous impact on the overall health of the organization. And then now tie that back to waste minimization, risk mitigation, being anti-fragile. It's a critical piece because mistakes are inevitable. That's what an incident is. An incident is an undesirable outcome.
That's number one principle of human performance. People make mistakes.
Yes, sir.
I think number two is along what you said just a while ago, you know, about how we view blame fixes nothing. That's a paraphrase of one of the five principles.
What's funny is as I was reviewing my notes before this, because I knew we were going to talk about, the first thing I talk about in the presentation I give on the pitfalls of incident investigation is blame. Number one, that's the first one I talk about. And I had a great conversation with James Junkin, if you know him. I know he's heavily involved in ASSP and Verifort. Anyway, James, at this point, for sure, one of my heroes, just a fantastic guy. But we talked about this during a Verifort conference this past year about some of these pitfalls. So yeah, blame. So an organization is confronted with an opportunity, or I say maybe presented or confronted, depending on the severity, with an opportunity when there is an incident. Are we willing to figure out what happened, why it happened, and really take the steps that we need to take or that we can take realistically to prevent something like this or something similar from happening again? And again, I'll harken back to a book because believe it or not, in this day and age, you can still learn from books. Dr. Jeff Oakley's book on accident investigation techniques. One of the cornerstone books for me that you should read as an HSE professional if you haven't read that book, the way he addresses multiple causation theory and what you do in an incident investigation and what the end result should be. It's not been matched in any of my other efforts to read and learn. It's something that's digestible and applicable by anyone at any level. I always put a lot of emphasis on that being one of the foundational practices that an organization has got to execute at a high level to realize high HSE performance. What do we do when there's an incident? Do we really get down? And I don't care what model you use. I don't care if it's Taproot or Fishbone or Human Performance, or you go back to the old ABCs of DuPont. I don't care what you use. As long as you find out in your investigation what the real causes were, and you're willing to go back as far as you need to or as deep as you need to, including some uncomfortable potentially causes identified with respect to management's involvement, and then say, okay, well, this is what we learned from it. Now, what are we going to do? What are our corrective actions? And now let's set measurables associated with those corrective actions. And another thing I talk about with respect to the pitfalls of an incident investigation is, first of all, not developing effective corrective actions or ineffective ones, and then failure to verify that those things worked. I love it when someone says, hey, man, look at this incident report. It's great. And I'll look at it, man, it's 12 pages of some fancy software, and it's just fantastic. I mean, they've got a timeline. They've applied the five whys to every step. They may have really gone deep in this thing and done something like design criteria analysis. And I'm like, well, this is incredibly impressive. And then I look at the corrective actions, and it says, have a stand down. What? that's the default answer. And I'm not picking on you drilling and completions guys, because I love y'all. But for real, that's their first, every time, that's their first corrective action. Oh, we're going to have a stand down. Sure. Yes, we need to make everybody aware of what happened as quickly as possible at a high level. But give us some corrective actions that have meat on the bone. And then the next thing is, let's revisit those within a designated timeline and ask ourselves, were these really effective corrective actions? Do we really see a change? And I won't say who the contractor is, but I mean, they're a worldwide contractor. I worked with them extensively over the years as a consultant, and then they worked for some of the organizations I worked for. Every time they had an incident, the answer was, we rewrote the policy. Okay, but the policy you wrote that was in place was violated by the employee. But your corrective action every single time we meet is rewrite the policy. We rolled out a new policy. Hey, at some point, all these policies become white noise to the end users.
That's kind of like the stand downs.
Right? We rewrote the policy. Well, why didn't you try to figure out, and I learned this one from my dad, why didn't you figure out why you didn't just do what you were supposed to do in the first place? I get that blame's not a piece of this, but accountability has to be a piece of it. But knowing where that accountability lies and how we're going to address it can become uncomfortable when you have some of these conversations. Well, this employee was trained. Okay. Was the training effective? Right? Was there a measurement of understanding? Can we validate that there was comprehension involved? Okay. Now let's go to, if you're going to say it's behavior, and I'm just going to use the old behavioral model because it's my favorite one, right? Was the employee overloaded? Was there an inappropriate action? Was there an inappropriate response? Okay. Was there an inappropriate action? Well, why did that employee feel like that action was okay? Sometimes, again, that takes us back to leadership. With respect to how I evaluate leadership failures, I'm pretty simplistic because I'm not that smart of a guy. So I drill it down to two things, accountability or allocation of resources. That is not always a comfortable conversation for leadership to have in an incident investigation, whether they're a vendor meeting with you or it's your own organization internally. That's one of the pitfalls, is being able to distinguish between causes and conditions, develop your corrective actions, measure those corrective actions, and not be so married to your original ideas that you're not willing to say, these have to be evergreen. You know, we have to be willing to constantly be critical of our own ideas and be prepared to pivot and change tactics if these tactics aren't working. And I know I went about 20 different directions in that last answer, so feel free to ask for clarification on any of that.
I think every one of those was important. I think you have to break down the matrix. You've got your leadership at the top. They've got to be a part of it. You've got your, I guess what you would call your mid-level managers, supervisors or whatever, and then you've got the worker. And there's a matrix for each one of those levels that they all need to be a part of and they all need to be involved in. What you said about when the behavior is not according to the policy, the big deal is asking the question, why? And then where does that fit in? Like the one example you used, maybe the employee, he didn't see the necessity of following that procedure. Well, somebody obviously in the mid-level management or even up in the leadership, they haven't made it clear as to why that's important.
Yes, sir. One of the other things that I've developed over the years with some folks, and I got to give credit to one of the main people that helped me develop this, was Rich Troyer. Rich and I worked together at Concho. Just a brilliant mind when it comes to understanding how operations and HSE integrates, and taught me a lot. So Rich, if you listen to this, you'll please do the podcast, because I think we'd all be better off if we got to hear your thoughts. But one of the things we talked about with respect to process application and behavior was, why don't people follow processes? Sometimes there's a lack of leadership, and sometimes with respect to process, there's a lack of a process. And what you get is an informal emergence. And I know that sounds like some big words to use, but it's pretty simple. People will find a way. You call it the get or done principle. They will get it done, right? The technical term we used was informal emergence. If you don't tell them how to do it, they'll figure out how to do it. And if there's no accountability for how it's supposed to be done, they're still going to get it done. You don't want folks field engineering solutions to complicated and dangerous problems, is what that boils down to.
That's exactly right. But that's one of the biggest mistakes sometimes companies make.
Yes, sir. A lot. They don't appreciate it. And then at the other end of the spectrum, you have, again, what my father called like White Castle syndrome, where somebody in a Houston or a Tulsa or an Oklahoma City or Denver office writes a policy or procedure and they chunk it over the wall to the peasants and go, hey, do that. They're not allowed to engage at all in the development of the process and go through like a PHA where everybody has a say and we thought about this. This could happen. That could happen. Yeah, I would say that's both ends of the spectrum. We neither want informal emergence, nor do you want sort of dispassionate, disconnected, unrealistic policies and procedures written an operations manual written by someone who's never done it. The old joke of the picture of the safety person in the reflective vest. I don't know what you're doing, but my book says you're doing it wrong.
What you've just said, you said in 30 minutes what I heard in 2 days at the IADC, HSE, and Health, Safety, Environmental, and Training Conference a couple of weeks ago in Houston. I've really enjoyed this conversation, and you've given everybody a lot to think about, and we're going to put your LinkedIn contact information in case some folks want to reach out to you. You are a wealth of knowledge and expertise, and I really like this concept of return on investment for HSE and for all performance, because that's the bottom line. Getting especially the folks at the top to understand that's really critical. Before we sign off here, you got any other words of wisdom?
Maybe just to put a bow on the last thing you talked about with a sales tactic, if you will, because we are salespeople in HSE. We're constantly trying to talk operations out of their money because we're not ringing the cash register, right? I would say one of the tools I use as an example to give context to that conversation with operations, and regardless of the industry, and I'm sure you can draw some kind of parallel for yourself, but I've been confronted with, what's the big deal if they wear their safety glasses or their hard hat or their FR? I mean, if they're out there getting the job done, they're getting it done. And my response to that is, when you look at high performance organizations, high performance individuals, because that's what an organization is, right? It's a collection of individuals. When those folks, either at the macro level, right, so organizationally, or the micro, the individual, are willing to take shortcuts as simple as meeting the most basic requirements to be on that location, what other shortcuts are they taking in putting your system in place that's supposed to make you money that you don't even know about? There's a standard of behavior that we should expect from employees at all levels. I don't care if that person's just the welder's helper. Whatever their role is, the standard of performance needs to be the standard of performance. Nick Saban talks about this. Sports is not a metaphor for life. Sports is life. We just get to see it unfold over four quarters or three periods or whatever. Performance is performance is performance. And when I start having those conversations with operations, you just see the light bulbs sometimes come on and go, oh, yeah, if they're not going to wear their safety glasses, you know, are they really going to torque all the bolts to spec on my location? Because if they don't do that, I'm going to have real problems. When I'm shut down, I can't make money. When I can't make money, we have problems.
Exactly. Exactly.
That is one of the tactics I've been able to employ. Maybe is try to apply that to your own industry. Find a parallel for yourself to use as a tool. And listen, anyone, feel free to reach out to me on LinkedIn. I'm going to tell you, I certainly don't have all the answers. I'm the aggregation of all my missteps over the years and the lessons I've learned from it and no more. But I probably know someone who can help you. I'm happy to point you in the right direction. I'm happy to tell you what books I've read. And be prepared, if you do reach out to me, there's a good chance I'm going to reach back out to you and ask questions too. So I think we all need to focus on attaching our ego to the success of the process and our organizations and not ourselves individually. And the more of us that do that, quite frankly, the better we'll make this whole profession.
Oh, that is a perfect way to tie a knot in that. That is exactly right. And that's what we hope this podcast accomplishes. Chris, again, thanks for taking the time. Really appreciate your insights here. If you're willing, I'm very interested in talking about produced water and what's happening with that from the environmental perspective. Having a conversation about what Deep Blue's doing, I think, would make for another good show. And if it's all right with you, we'll plan on that in the future.
Yeah, it'd be my pleasure. As long as you let me bring in a ringer, like our chief commercial officer, who knows more about this than I do.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, that's, again, that's the reason for the success of this show. It's not the quality of the host. It's the quality of the guest we get. Absolutely. So, folks, thanks for listening. As always, hope you've benefited from this conversation. You've learned some things and haven't been bored in the process. Tune in again next week for another edition of the OGGN HSE podcast. Please post us on LinkedIn and your other social media. Just like Chris was saying, we've got to get this message out to everybody. We've got to communicate. So tell everybody about this podcast. Tell everybody to listen. And please listen again next week, and we'll see you next time.
Tune in next week for another engaging episode of the Oil and Gas HSE podcast, a production of the Oil and Gas Global Network. Learn more at OGGN.com.